Well, we're still in the book of Daniel today, and we're going to talk about the second chapter. We have already discussed there all of chapter 1 down through verse 21, and today we're going to look at the second chapter and possibly be able to go down about to verse 23. We'll not take up a lot of time trying to review because there's a great deal of information in today's lesson. We're going to see, first of all, in verse 1 to 10, as our outline indicates, that the king had a very disturbing dream. We're referring, of course, to Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon in the days of Daniel the prophet. Now, we find out something about the dream in verse 1 of the second chapter as to the time of it and the effect that it had upon the king himself. And in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. You'll note that dreams is in the plural there, more than one, and you'll have reference to that another time or two. But finally, when we get on down to the heart of the lesson, it's just dreams, singular. So whether he had a series of dreams on the same subject, I don't know. But it seems to be just the one dream is what he talks about after a while. But here it's spoken of as more than one dream, dreams. Wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him. Looking at that, you can see that he was rather shook up in his mind, and he wasn't able to sleep. He evidently awoke out of his sleep during the dream. He was alarmed, he was disturbed, and the like. Now again, we have a slight problem here in chronology. We had a similar problem back in chapter 1, though I believe this one can be explained from different standpoints. When we read this, we say here, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Well, we learned in chapter 1, in verse 5, that Daniel and his companions would be in school 3 years. So it sounds as if the 3 years were over when we got down to the latter part of chapter 1. But here in chapter 2 it says the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. So we have questions to come up. Did this happen during the training period of the 3 years? Or was it after the presentation to the king? If so, how could it be called the second year of his reign? Somebody answered it this way, and I gave some of the explanations here. They said Daniel was just in school 1 year. He was so smart, he got out early. There's nothing in the scripture, though, to indicate that that was the case. Some say, well, it was a part of 2 years and one whole year. You say, well, what do you mean? Like this. Nebuchadnezzar reigned with his father conjointly there for 2 years. And then he reigned 2 more years after his father died, which would make 4 years. But when it says here the second year, it would simply mean that this is the second year that he reigns complete king without his father. But there's nothing to indicate that his father and he reigned conjointly during this time. His father died, as I understand it, as he came back from Jerusalem. So then we would have to expel those ideas as being incorrect too. So, as always, the best interpretation is to stay with the literal sense of the Bible. And so what we're going to say is that this happened during the 3-year training period. You say, well, how do you know? There's certain things in the chapter that would cause me to believe that it did happen during that time. In other words, this is the second year of the reign. There's still another year of the training period. It's not over with yet. He said, well, it was ended back there in chapter 1, yes, but he's going back and telling some events that happened before the 3-year training was over. That's not unusual in the Bible. Now, these fellows are still trainees during the time of this lesson, and it is really just the second year of his reign. Daniel was not summoned with the rest of the wise men, as we're going to see in the next verse there. Furthermore, he disassociates himself with the other wise men of Babylon down in verse 27. He said, you mean all the wise men can't answer this dream? Well, he didn't include himself in them, see. He's still in training, so he wasn't yet reckoned as a wise man. So it is during the 3-year training period. So that little discussion there that is often raised is settled. Now, somebody said, well, I note here that God spoke to Nebuchadnezzar by means of a dream. Does that mean that God today speaks to us by means of dreams? The answer to that is no. I do not believe God today speaks to us by dreams. They did not have the complete revelation of God's Word back in the Old Testament time. Certainly they didn't have the New Testament like we have. But now that we have God's perfect revelation, there is no longer any need for dreams and visions and all of these things that we hear so much about. You say, well, God used it then. Yes, but he doesn't use it anymore, because the period of time during which he spoke to his people by means of dreams and visions is past. It certainly was a means of communication back there, though, before we had the complete revelation of the Bible. So we make just a brief observation there about dreams. God in the Old Testament time did sometimes use dreams. Genesis 20, you had the dream of Abimelech concerning Abram's wife. You had a dream of Joseph that he told his brethren about in Genesis 37. And then you had dreams that happened to Joseph down there in Egypt. And he interpreted the dreams and the like. And there are many, many other dreams that's in the Old Testament. Joseph had a dream about the birth of Christ in the New Testament. And the book of Numbers, chapter 12 and verse 6, tells us that God did in the Old Testament time speak to his prophets by means of dreams and visions. So, that was a means of communication. You say, well, I've had a lot of dreams. Reckon the Lord was trying to tell me something. No, I don't think so. I don't believe he speaks to us today by dreams. Not all dreams in the Old Testament times were means of divine communication to people. There were times that it was nothing more than a bad conscience, I guess you'd call it. Or maybe the fact that a man ate too much and he couldn't sleep at night and he went into subconscious state like. Well, why do you say that? Well, in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 7, for in the multitude of dreams and many words there are also diverse vanities, but fear thou God. So it's more important to fear God than have these dreams of vanity. So dreams in the Old Testament time was not always God's way of speaking to people, but sometimes he did speak in that manner. He did hear to the king. Now let's see what's going to happen. The king's going to call in all the intellectual fellows of the kingdom of Babylon, all the brain trustees. They're all going to be commanded to appear before him. That's in Daniel 2 and 2. Then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dreams. Still dreams. Look at the language there. So they came and stood before the king. Now let's look at those four terms we have there. Magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, and Chaldeans. What does that mean? Well, we've already had the definition of two of those, but we quickly repeat. The magicians were the sacred writers. The astrologers were the Babylonian priests, and they did dabble in what's called today astrology. Though they were more than astrologers, they did go under what we'd call today astrologers. Now here for the first time, we have this term sorcerers. Sometimes they were called wizards and witches in the Old Testament. They practiced the black arts. In other words, they worshiped the devil. And they did magic by the power of the devil. They were indeed devil-controlled individuals. I gave a number of scriptures there that you can look up, and all those terms, wizards, witches, sorcerers, it all has to do with the same kind of people. It comes from the same root word in the Hebrew, but we have different translations in our version. And then he speaks there in verse 2 of the Chaldeans. And that was one of the tribes that made up Babylon. According to Isaiah 23 and 13, it was the original tribe of Babylon. In other words, the native people of the kingdom of Babylon were Chaldeans. Nebuchadnezzar is a Chaldean. Daniel's not a Chaldean. He's from Judah. He's a Jew. But he's living in Chaldea, you see. So this is the native people that lived in Babylon, the same type of people, nationality and all that, that the king himself is of. So we'll just simply say that it is one of the tribes which originally made up the kingdom of Babylon in the early days. Now we're going to go on down and see what we have here in verse 3 and 4. And the king wants them to tell him what this dream was that he had and what it meant. Of course, they're going to have a problem there because they said, now if you tell us what you dreamed, then we'll tell you what it meant. But he said, I want to know what a dream, I want to know what it means. As you go down through the lesson, you get this impression. You get the idea that the king thinks he's been taken in by these scoundrels and he's out to get them killed. He hasn't forgotten his dream and they don't think he has. Though he says he has, I'm inclined to think that they didn't think that he had forgotten, that they thought it was a plot to get him killed. That's probably what it was, though we may never know for sure. And the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream. Now see, he brings it down to one. And my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac. Now there's where the Chaldean tongue starts. It's been written in Hebrew, but now it goes over to Syriac, or the Gentile tongue. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever. That's a common terminology. You may remember about how God saved the king and all these expressions that we have in our English ancestry. Long live the king and all of that. It's just a way of speaking about kings in that day. O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said unto the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. In other words, I don't remember what it is. Well, now, if he'd completely forgotten it and they did tell him, how would he remember? You ever thought about that? I'm showing you that he hadn't forgotten the dream entirely. He's putting these boys to the test and they're going to fail. I don't think he's forgotten the dream. He said, though, said, in other words, he's telling them at least that he has said, it's gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made dunghills. So he put them in a precarious situation there. He said, if you don't tell me what this dream means, then I'll just have you chopped up in little bitty pieces. I'll kill the whole bunch. In other words, he's going to make them do their best. Because, you know, if a man's life's at stake, he's going to do his best. If he can do it, he's going to do it, if it means his life. Of course, they couldn't do it. They don't believe he's forgotten the dream, so they keep pleading with him, said, now go on and tell us the dream, and then we'll tell you what it meant. But he still won't cooperate with them. Now let's look in verse 6. But if ye will show the dream and the interpretation thereof, he's going to promise them now some gifts, see if they'll come across. But if ye will show the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. They still are pleading now to find out what the dream is. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it. They still think he's lying. And he is, I'm convinced, the way it reads. Because after all, if he'd forgotten the dream, they could have told him anything. See, he wouldn't have known. But he does know what the dream is. He's putting them to the test. So they're in trouble. They don't believe he's forgotten it, and they're pleading more or less for time right now. But he's going to make a decree. He's going to make it the law of the land. They have to tell what the dream is or die. The king answered and said, I know of a certainty that ye would gain the time, because ye see the thing is gone from me. In other words, you're going to stall for time and save your life. But if ye will not make known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you, for ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Just what he meant by the time being changed, I don't know. Maybe he meant that he'd go on and get busy with the affairs of the kingdom and he'd forget all about, you know, the dream and wanting to know what it meant. Or it may be that they were saying that maybe we'll have a new king pretty soon, you know, and he won't make a demand like this of us. This fellow's trying to get us killed. So they were going to stall for time, till the time be changed, either new king or he got a change of heart or something, you see. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall make known what ye can show me the interpretation. And I shall know that ye can show me the interpretation thereof. He's putting them to the test. He said, now you fellows claim to be smart. You claim to know how to interpret dreams, to have the help of the gods. then I want you to prove it. Right now is a good way to find out just how much you really know. Well, they're in a mess because they really are imposters. They can't do that. And now their life's at stake. So I don't know. It looks like there's no way out for them at this present time. So the plea of the wise men goes on. But the king said there's no altering of this decree. This is the law. You either tell me or you're going to be cut up in pieces. The Chaldeans answered and said before the king. There is not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. In other words, they admitted their ignorance there. That's pretty good. They should have done that a long time ago. They admitted their inability to make known the interpretation of the dream. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things of any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. They are simply saying there that this request is too demanding. We can't comply with it. You've asked more than we're able to perform. Nobody would make an outlandish request like this. Nobody had ever heard of such a request. All we do is interpret dreams. We don't remember what somebody else dreams. After all, if you can't remember it, what makes you think we can? So it sounded like they had a pretty good argument, didn't it? And so they go on pleading now for some relief for this decree. And it is a rare thing that the king requires. We've never heard of the like. There is none other that can show it before the king except the gods. Now, they believed in many gods. They were Babylonians. They didn't believe in the true God, Jehovah. They believed in many gods. Had a lot of gods in Babylon. So, you can see the heathen concept of the gods there. They thought that the gods knew more than man. But the heathens didn't believe that the gods were all wise like we know our God to be. They were higher than man. They lived up above, but they were not all wise like our God is. So he said, now, they said, this is a great request, and nobody but the gods of Babylon could make known this request. And said, we don't seem to have them down here with us right now, because they said, whose dwelling is not with flesh. You see, the gods of Babylon were never thought of to come down like Jesus did and become incarnate, to be wrapped in human flesh. So they said, now the only ones that could interpret this dream and make known are the gods above. And said, they're not down here on the earth. And said, there's no way we can get in touch with them. So they're more or less saying, we can't do it. We can't do it. You've got to change the decree. We can't do it. For this cause, the king was angry and very furious, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Said, just kill a whole bunch of them. They're imposters. They're liars. They can't do what they say they can do. So just cut them all up in little bitty pieces. And so it doesn't look too good for them right now. And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain. And they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. All the wise men would include even the trainees that were in the school of Babylon. The wise men are mostly in the palace there, but Daniel and his companions are not in the palace because they're in school. They're not out of school yet. They're trainees. And that proves that it is the second year of his reign, like I said. Now we go down to verse 14 there, through 18 of the second chapter, and we have Daniel's prayer for wisdom. You're going to find out that he doesn't know anything about the decree. He's totally ignorant of it when they come in there. As we start here in verse 14. Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. You're going to find out a great deal about the sterling character of this man Daniel. He was a very, very intelligent man. The very manner in which he deals with this captain of the king's guards is remarkable. The providence of God can be seen in all of these events. God ordained it so. Ordinarily, the captain of the guard would not even take time to listen to what a man said. His orders were to execute him, not to hear their speeches, but to kill him. But he listened to Daniel. Why? God ordained it so. So he did listen to him. That right there is a great act of God's mercy and providence. Of Because ordinarily this man who's a soldier would have went in with his sword and just split their heads open. That'd been all of it. Killed them on the spot. His orders, like I said, were to execute them. Kill them. Cut them up in little bitty pieces. Not to hear their complaints. But anyway, Daniel is given a hearing here. And Daniel, of course, is very wise. He's very wise in what he says. He's going to show that he is indeed a great man of God. You say, well, if some fellow had come in with a sword going to cut me up in little bitty pieces, I probably would have tried to hightail it out the door and see if I could get away from him. Well, you wouldn't have gotten away from all the soldiers of Babylon, even if you'd tried. So it would have been foolish to attempt, though human nature might have caused us to do that. But here we see Daniel. He doesn't panic. He's not in any despair, desperation. He's not given to any sort of frustration like we might be. But he speaks words of wisdom. The Bible says, Proverbs 15, verse 1, a soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. So Daniel is going to give that soft answer, going to speak forth words of truth and soberness. And so we find that he's going to address Arioch here, the king's captain. And he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is a decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. I assume he told him about what happened there in the palace. They couldn't interpret the dream. Now, why did the soldier take time to do that? Why didn't Daniel just get his head split open right on the start? Well, God had some more work for him to do, and it wasn't his time to die. And that's the very reason why it didn't happen that way. So now, Daniel goes to the king. Whether he actually appears before the king or goes through a messenger, I'm not sure. It sounds as if anyway he got in touch with him. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. Now that's really a lot of boldness. Here's a boy 15 years old who's a foreigner in a foreign land. He's only been here a little over a year now. And he says, I'm smarter than all these other fellows. That I'll tell you the interpretation of that dream and what the dream was if you'll give me time. Well, now, ordinarily, the king, who was already mad at these fellows, would have said, time, I've already given the decree. They're all going to die, whether they like it or not. But he altered the decree. Look at the providence of God again. He wouldn't do it for anybody else, but he's going to do it for Daniel, a foreigner. He doesn't even know, a little old boy, 15 years old. Ordinarily, the king wouldn't have paid a fellow like that any attention at all. He'd have killed him on the spot. God is surely in all of this. And so we find that there's going to be quite a prayer meeting take place that night. I can imagine that if a fellow's life was in the balances, he might have done some fervent and earnest praying. And so there was a great united prayer meeting. I believe we ought to have united prayer meetings. Jesus said, if two will agree upon earth touching any matter, let him ask of God and it'll be given. United prayer, if two be agreed, see, more than one. That's one great thing I believe about coming together in the church. We can have united prayer. We may not all pray at the same time audibly, but while one leads the congregation, all the others may be praying silently to God too, both men and women. So that's really what ought to be done when we have some man leading the public prayer. All should be praying silently in their heart to the Lord, because that individual don't pray for you. He's praying for himself. That's the only one he can pray for to mount anything. So here's quite a prayer meeting. Then Daniel went into his house. He's not in the palace. He's in a house. And made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. And so they're going to pray, perhaps pray like they've never prayed before. That they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret. That Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. I believe that praying friends are valuable friends. How much is a person worth that we can go to and pray with? More than we may ever know. Praying friends are very valuable. He didn't start off by saying, now, give us the dream and the interpretation. He prayed what? For mercy. Why? Because if he doesn't have the mercy of God, then the revelation will not come. The mercy is necessary to the revelation. Sometime, maybe instead of praying for the object that we'd like to have, we ought to pray that God would be merciful to us. And after he's merciful to us, then grant us this request that we've made known. So there's quite a prayer meeting taking place there. It's an earnest prayer. It's a prayer for mercy, and then that the God of heaven would make known the great secret concerning the dream as well as the interpretation. They not only now need to know the interpretation, they must know what the dream is too. Well, did they pray a little while and go to bed and go to sleep? It sounds like it to me. Well, they didn't get the answer just then. Why did they quit praying? They evidently believed God would give it to them before morning. And God did give it to Daniel, not to the others, but he gave it to Daniel before morning. Remember back how that we were told in chapter 1 that it was given to Daniel to understand dreams and visions. Dreams and visions. We had our lesson here last Monday night, and Brother Tom Heisel came around after it's over. Said, in view of the fact that it says back in chapter 1 that Daniel could understand dreams and visions, said that would imply to me that chapter 2 did happen during the time of the training period, because it's mentioned in connection with the schooling, not after the schooling. So he said, there's a good point there to prove that it is the second year, like you said. And I hadn't thought about that, but he's right. The chronology back over there in chapter 1 concerning the dreams and the visions would certainly point back in that direction. So I would say that maybe something there worth thinking about. Well, let's go on here now to see what's going to happen when the dream is revealed. In verse 19 to 23, I assume that during the course of the night, before the next day arrived, before tomorrow's sun, we'll say, that Daniel had this vision, during which he saw the dream, and he also was able to get the interpretation. God gave it to him. It was not something he did, because no man living could have done that. So the Babylonian men were mistaken. They said the dwellings of the gods is not with flesh. That's true of their gods. But the God of heaven did communicate himself to fleshly men on the earth. So they didn't know anything about the God of the Bible, you see. A lot of people don't. All right, let's look here now, beginning at verse 19, and we're going to see that the prayer was answered. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night's vision. I assume during the night. While he slept, while he's still praying, I don't know. It's not clear. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night's vision. I would say that, as Deuteronomy 29 and 29 says, the secret things belong unto the Lord our God. Those that he reveals belongs unto us. Well, here was some of those things that God revealed that belonged unto his children. Why? I don't know. That was his reason. God does show himself to those that fear him. There in Psalms 25 and 14, it tells us how that God will show himself to those that fear him. He will show unto them his secrets, his covenant, and all of that. Furthermore, the Bible says in James 1 and 15, if any man lack wisdom, and they sure needed some that night, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. Well, didn't they ask for wisdom? Didn't they get it? Wasn't that what God said he'd do? And then we're told in James 5 and 16 that the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Well, here were four men that prayed. They were righteous men. And their prayer availed much because God gave the answer. Very important that we note that in passing. Now then, the prayer of thanksgiving that is uttered here by Daniel is one of the great prayers of the Bible. We're nearing the time of the year when we are to be thankful to God for what he's done for us. We should be all the time, but this is one time set aside out of the year during which we think about God and how we ought to be thankful for what he's done. We call it Thanksgiving Day. It's one of the few holidays that I like. It's an American holiday. It's not necessarily a Bible holiday, but it certainly has a Bible basis to be thankful for what God's done. So you're going to find a great expression here about thanksgiving on the part of Daniel, whose life will now be saved. and who will be able to glorify the God of heaven. And so we look now at verse 20 to 22. Daniel answered and said, and my, what great truths we're about to see here. We're going to see how that God is supreme over both man and all nature. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever. You know, the name of God stands for God Himself and all of His glorious attributes. The name of the man to us means the man himself, really. That's how we identify him. Many times in the Bible when it talks about in the name of Christ, it's with respect to His person that we do it, by His authority, His rights and privileges that is granted to us. So He blesses the name of God, not curses the name of God. A lot of people do that. But He blesses the name of God forever and ever. He is blessed forever and ever, whether we bless Him or not. But it's good on our part if we bless Him. Because if we do not bless Him, then we'll live to regret it. So Daniel blesses the name of God. And then he sets forth in no uncertain terms how that God is a supreme being over all creatures. For wisdom and might are His. But he did give a portion of that wisdom and might to Daniel. But he acknowledged what? That God gave it all to him. It all came from God. So all wisdom and all might, whether it be physical strength or spiritual power, comes from God. He's the source of it. He's the beginning of all of it. And then in verse 21, we see God's sovereign control over all the changes that take place in this life. He changeth the times and the seasons. Well, we're going out of summer into fall, and very soon we'll be going into winter. Who changes the seasons? We don't. We don't have anything to do with that. God does. So the seasons of the year are not under the control of chance or blind fate. They're bound by established laws of nature that God made. But there's one thing about it. The lawgiver is not bound by the laws. He can change the times and the seasons. Brother Billy told us here in our devotional this morning before our Bible study how that we're seeing remarkable changes in the weather conditions. Out in Arizona, where they have very little rainfall at all, they're having floods. And over here where we normally have quite a bit of rainfall throughout the south and all the way up here into the Ohio Valley, we're just not having any rain much of any kind. It's different than it ordinarily is. Who made the change? God did. God did. Why He did it, I don't know. It's not my business to know. I just know that He did it. Why do we have day and night? God makes it all come to pass. Spring and winter. Why do we have cloudy days and sunshiny days? God makes it all like that. Why are we young men, middle age, and old men? God makes it so. So everything that takes place, all the changes in nature as well as the changes in man are brought to pass by what Daniel calls here the God of heaven, whose name is to be blessed forever and ever. He changeth the times and the seasons. And then a lot of people don't believe it, but it's very plainly stated He's controlling the political world in the next statement there. He removeth kings. He'll remove Nebuchadnezzar for a time, and then He'll bring him back. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. Sometimes we have the idea that by voting that we change it all. Well, God may work through that means. Nevertheless, God will determine who will rule and who will not rule in the world. Well, you should read all those scriptures that I give there that show how that God's in control of the political world. Now, I want us to take a few moments to go to the book of Job and read some there. Some of the greatest verses in the Bible on the sovereignty of God over the political world in which we find ourselves in our modern day and age. In Job, the 12th chapter, beginning at verse 16. With Him, speaking about God now, the God of heaven, with Him is strength and wisdom, just exactly what we had there in Daniel. The deceived and the deceiver are His. Quite a statement, isn't it? He leadeth counselors away spoiled and maketh the judges fools. He looseth the bounds of kings and girdeth their loins with a girdle. He leadeth princes away spoiled and overthroweth the mighty. He removeth away the speech of the trusty and taketh away the understanding of the aged. He poureth contempt upon princes and weakeneth the strength of the mighty. He discovereth the deep things out of darkness and bringeth out to light the shadow of death. He increaseth the nations and destroyeth them. He enlargeth the nations and straighteneth them again. He taketh away the heart of the chief of the people of the earth and causes them to wander in the wilderness where there is no way. They grope in darkness without light. He maketh them to stagger like a drunken man. But there's one thing very evident when you read those verses. God is in control of the political world. He is setting up kings and he's taking down kings. And he does it all according to his own good pleasure. So all the revolutions that take place in the world, all the changing of the new governments throughout all the land in which we live, as well as the world as a whole, God is back behind the scene, putting kings on the throne and taking kings off of the throne. So God's still running the world. The devil's not. Men are not. God is still ruling the world. And then, again, it is said that he is the source of all knowledge and understanding. He giveth wisdom unto the wise. Daniel's a wise man. Now he's been given more wisdom. And knowledge to them that know understanding. Daniel has understanding. He's been given more. And then he goes on to tell us about how that God reveals things. He revealeth the deep and secret things. Like, how in the world could Daniel have known what this man dreamed? That was a secret. But God what? Revealed it to him, see. He revealed it to him. How could he have known what that king dreamed in the black hours of the midnight upon his bed? He wasn't even in the palace. Wasn't anywhere near the king. And the king said he'd forgotten it. And after all, there was no way that a man could know except God tell him. Make it known to him. And so he says here, he knoweth what is in the darkness. And the light dwelleth with him. Now note that light said to dwell with God. He's called the Father of Lights, L-I-G-H-T-S, the Father of Lights. He's the God of light. In him is no darkness at all, the Bible said, but he knows what's in the darkness. Now, the term darkness is always associated with the devil, the prince of darkness, we call the devil. The blackness of the darkness forever, the place where hell is and the devil will be cast. Darkness in the Bible is associated with the devil. Light always associated with God. It's always so. We're the children of the light that are saved. They're called children of darkness. 1 Thessalonians 4, you can read about that. The children of light and children of darkness. So, it's said here that God knows what's in the darkness. Have you ever thought about how that men go out under the cover of darkness to try to hide their sins? For instance, what happens, people, they go out maybe on Saturday night, like it was last night, they go out under the cover of darkness and do all kinds of evil, wicked deeds. The reason that they go out and do that under the cover of darkness is they don't want the people in general to know what they're doing. They're going to hide it more or less from people. Though I grant they're more bold than they used to be. But they want to hide out. They don't want nobody to know what to do. So they go out under the cover of darkness. But what's the problem? They may hide from their neighbors and their friends. They can't hide from God. He knows what's in the darkness. So going out in the dark to hide from God, silly. You might as well stand in the light. He can see as well in one as the other. There is no way to hide from God. In Psalms 139, verse 11 and 12, if I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee. So with God, there is no day and night. There is with us, but not with him. He doesn't have any day and night. It's all just one big eternal day with him. He can see all the time very well. And then we have words of gratitude for the answered prayer, especially there in Daniel 2:23. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hath given me wisdom and might, and hath made known unto me now what we desire of thee. For thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter." Sometimes we pray and God gives the answer, but do we thank God for it? Add the little note here. Sometimes we're Christians in asking and atheists in thanksgiving. Sad, but it's true. We pray and say, "God, we need this." God gives it. Then we don't ever thank him for it. We just like atheists when it comes to making thanksgiving to God. Terrible thing to pray as Christians, receive as Christians, and then after that to behave like atheists and infidels. So when God gives us a blessing, we ought to be thankful to him for what he's done. May the Lord help us not to pray without also giving thanks to our God for the prayer that he answers for us. Okay, that'll do it for today. We'll stop there and study more in the book of Daniel next week.